Hello and welcome to the You and You Merit podcast. I'm Howard Hudson and today I'm joined by Professor Luke Souter. Besides being my boss, Luke is Director of You and You Merit, Dean of the School of Governance, and in September 2012 will take on the role of Rector Magnificus at Maastricht University. Now Luke, some people bulldoze their way to the top, but that doesn't seem to be your style. How exactly did you do it?
I don't think I did anything to get myself... ultimately in this position. I think it's part of the career of any individual, that is that he happens to be seeing opportunities where he is himself active in pursuing those opportunities. Some of these opportunities fail, for sure. Other opportunities succeed. And I think it's over time one probably learns much more from the failures in terms of knowing how further to build up a career which is based on, I would say, certainly in an academic environment, a dosis of search for new insights, which I think motivates any researcher, and at the same time, what I would call academic entrepreneurship. That is to say, are there opportunities, and do I jump on those, follow those, or, which is also very valid, not enter in those opportunities because I consider that what I'm doing myself is much more interesting. So this is a little bit sort of a history of life. And then this last opportunity is really the request to lead the university, or at least to lead, to be responsible for the academic part of Maastricht University, is also a fantastic challenge.
But it's not just about opportunities, it's about building relationships. I mean, if I could describe you in one word, it would be probably mercurial.
No, for sure, it is building up networks, but it's within a very strong local context, these networks. So you have your networks are putting yourself in all sorts of directions. You have networks, and think of the UNU. These are international networks. There are networks which are of a very different kind from the old merit networks when we started with the research institute here at Maastricht University, which were very much networks which were very much focused on the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. So this has been a dramatic shift in the way these networks allowed yourself to continue to develop an institution such as merit when it was started up to the UNU.
So it wouldn't have been possible 50 years ago, so.
No, it wouldn't be possible 50 years ago. It would be possible, and that's why I'm always talking about opportunities, because it's only possible within this context of when these opportunities pass by, so to say, and when you're challenged to either respond to those opportunities or basically to refuse to respond to those opportunities, which can also be a strategy which is perfectly justified.
Okay, so rewinding to when you were a student yourself or even before, mm-hmm. And when did you first realize that you wanted to be an economist, and do the same things still motivate you today?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I realized very early in life that I wanted to be an economist. This was, of course, these were the 60s, so I'm really a child of the 60s. And at that time, I mean, I always find it also historically interesting, if you look at the data, the economic data, the inequality at the world level was probably never as large as it was in the late 60s or the early 70s. You had a phase of the beginning of decolonization. You had a phase of rapid growth in Europe, in Japan, following the Second World War, of course, which meant that the rich OECD countries witnessed very rapid growth, whereas the developing countries had very low growth rates. And accumulated over time, this was really reflected in a position that, in terms of the wealth, the North or the OECD world, the rich OECD world, had really income levels, percentages of world GDP, which were the highest if you would look through the history back to, say, the Industrial Revolution and back to the 18th century. So that period in the 60s was really a period in which you were, as a student, extremely motivated, wanting to contribute something to this inequality, to this injustice, which was very strongly felt in my case. So,
that was in Ghent.
No, this was still as in secondary school in Brussels, okay, as a school kid, and then afterwards, when I then chose to pursue my university studies in economics in Ghent, then you started really to, of course, realize that the world was much more complex, that economics was a constraining in many areas, that the whole ideas of development economics was pretty complex, and I specialized then in development economics as my, say, special master.
In Africa, some people are now blaming commodity speculators for pushing more people towards famine. And here in Europe, some blame credit default swaps for deepening the euro crisis. Now, okay, I'm not an economist, but I mean, in basic terms, is this a failure of regulation or just side effects of financial innovation?
No, it's a failure of regulation, absolutely. It's certainly something which is associated with financial innovations in the sense that new opportunities were there for innovators in the financial area to come up with new products, providing new services in terms of risk diversification, in terms of various forms of arbitrage, of uncertainties. And with the digital technologies, of course, these products could be spread much more quickly across the world. So technology is certainly behind these new financial products and services. But they were, of course, within an environment in which the regulatory environment has dramatically been changed. And the whole liberalization of the sector has been very much instrumental in allowing for products to emerge, which basically increased dramatically the risk to the system, to the whole financial system. And of course, in the European case, highly specific to Europe, of course, the monetary union and the creation of the euro was also something which was carried out without really reflecting on the long-term systemic risks of no longer having the freedom of exchange rate adjustments, particularly for the peripheral regions or peripheral countries in Europe. So all this is part of a lack of regulation, in the sense of a lack of, you could say it's, and that's why the institute here, you and you, Mary, together with the School of Governance, perfectly cover this area. You could say it's a balancing act between innovation, dynamics, the continuous stream of new product services coming onto the markets, coming onto society, and on the other hand, the governance of this and the regulation of this. And if you don't regulate this, if you say simply we allow the market to operate, you will see that you run dramatic systemic risks, and that we need regulation because some of those innovations, new technologies, are challenging certain ethical, certain values, certain financial imbalances, uncertainties, that basically we need the same knowledge both in the private sector as we need it in the public regulatory sector to keep balance with each other and to make sure that the regulation stays at the same level, so to say, of the innovative potential within a sector such as finance.
So this is a painful rebalancing which is going to last a generation? Or
it's, on some areas, regulation can be very fastly introduced. You can think of the Independent Commission on Banking in the UK. If you decide really to separate the functions of banks back to the household saving bank function, and on the other hand, the investment side and the way you carry out financial investments worldwide and you use the opportunities at the global level, introducing that kind of regulation will certainly create an enormous shock into the sector itself. But it's just an issue about political courage and belief that this need for re-regulation is absolutely essential. So in this sense, that the impact of this can be pretty immediate. When you talk about the euro and the way the euro can restore confidence, can restore growth, and particularly growth in the peripheral countries, which are suffering most from huge sovereign debts and from non-competitiveness because of the euro, well, there you're talking very much about a long-term adjustment, which very few people are prepared to discuss about today, and which is probably the most fundamental challenge for the survival of the euro, whether indeed Greece or whether Portugal or whether Italy or Spain can indeed create economic activities within their borders which will be competitive at the world level using the euro.
What does your new appointment mean for UN University? Will you still work on UN issues like innovation for international development, or will you focus more on local concerns?
Well, clearly, the first implication, of course, is that I will no longer be the UNU Merit Director and that somebody else will be there in my place. Well, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, a position of rector at Maastricht University means, of course, that you have a pretty voluminous amount of management tasks, of ceremonial functions where you are requested to be present, such as the PhD ceremonies, many other day-to-day meetings you have with the deans of the various faculties of the universities, you have interactions with student bodies, etc. So I still hope very much that I will have time to do some research, that I will also have time to give presentations, to participate now and then in conferences in my own research field, and of course that also with respect to development, I will be able still to here and there, if not write academic papers, then at least write policy reports or policy views or policy briefs on addressing some of the most important issues which are dominating the development economics innovation community.
You're from Brussels, and you've lived in Maastricht for 25 years now?
Yes.
Your CV is full of references to UN, EU, and other international organisations. Just to cap everything off, do you think the world's outgrown the nation state, given the fact that your home country has lived quite well without a national government for the last year and a half or 2 years almost?
Well,
I know it's a big question to end on, but still.
Yes, well, no, I think that I still would argue that we lack dramatically global governance institutions who have real power. There are very few of those. The WTO is one of those. There are a couple of others more in the military sphere, NATO, etc. But if you look at the traditional UN agencies, they are agencies which are based on soft power. So when we look at all the major issues which are of a global nature, think of climate change, think of energy supply, think of migration, think of food security, in all these areas we lack a clear global governance structure which would be of such a nature that it could also sanction, impose measures, etc. And I think at that level, I would still argue that the regulation and the governance is still very much a system which is nation-built, in Belgium even regional-built, and that is still very much dominant. That's not too much of a problem in emerging countries, because that's part of their identity and their national identity. And you see that this, if you succeed in mixing this building up of national governance with national institutions, it gives some pride to the people of those countries, etc. And that works, I think it works pretty well, has worked very well over the last 10, 20 years now in the famous large emerging countries, the BRICS. If you look at some of the more unstable, fragile state regimes, you see that this typically fails. And this is, of course, one of the big concerns of the fact that large parts of our young population is still in these countries, which are fragile states, also in the Arab Spring countries, whereby the expectations, the aspirations are massive. And the question is, of course, whether these countries will succeed in getting this institution building and these national governance structures under control. And I think if you then compare this with our old Europe, and the institutions in our old Europe, well, there, it's probably the other direction. It is that these institutions have probably, as you rightly point out, overlived, survived
their usefulness.
Their usefulness, precisely. And that in some areas you have pure political battles between passing on the responsibility, what we refer to as subsidiarity, passing on these responsibilities to a higher level, a European level, opposition from national policymakers, opposition from national policymakers' supporters, which are then incentivized to turn back to national values to justify the importance of the national political system. So I'm still on this side. I admit that I'm a typical Belgian who doesn't believe so much in the power of the national state, or the nation state, and believes much more that there is a movement in the old Europe towards a more European power, recognition of the variety in Europe of cultures, of languages, of tastes, of habits, and that the challenge is really how do we develop there an economic system which is not just raising economic growth but also raises welfare, development, quality of life, and I would say maybe most of all puts Europe back in the front seat with respect to broader values of human rights, of being there as one of the oldest democracies in the world and being still a sort of guiding or shining example of what a society could be. So that's sort of my ideal picture, but I'm afraid that we are far removed from that.
We live in hope.
Yes.
Luke, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.